reasonably soon, and hopefully the other members will get here. I think there have been caucuses or other kinds of activities that have delayed people. We're going to start with this informational meeting dealing with criminal fines and assessment account overview. Mr. McGee.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Marks will.
And Steve Marks, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve Marks, Governor's Senior Policy Advisor. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to overview the changes the governor is proposing for the criminal fines and assessment account. I want to briefly cover our primary reasons for the changes, the effect the proposed policy changes will have on distribution of the CFAA, and then Mr. McGee will cover in detail the history of the fund, but also to cover in detail the actual specific budget recommendations made by the governor. And before I go deeper in that conversation, I want to say at the outset that we want to work with this committee and interested legislators to craft a sound policy for the future distribution of CFAA funds. The ideas and policy choices that we're presenting to you are certainly not locked in stone. We think there are reasoned choices, and we're committed to working with you to achieve our common objectives. And there are two primary policy objectives the governor and the legislature have expressed through prior actions. One is the objective of providing at least 16 weeks of basic police training. The second objective is to provide greater accountability over the expenditures of CFAA funds. And last session, I believe it was last session or the one prior, the legislature provided some direction to DPSST to move to 16 weeks of police training. In working towards this goal, it's become clear that we cannot meet these expectations with our current facilities. And we can't meet them efficiently just in terms of what we have available and the infrastructure we have for training. And you'll hear more about that issue when DPSST presents its budget this afternoon. But the lack of adequate resources for police training is a serious issue for Oregon. Police training and policing powers are one of the most fundamental powers our governments have. And we all know the importance that police have in maintaining our community public safety and the well-being of our communities. And we also know the conflicts that occur when officers have a lack of training, and we've seen some examples of that recently. So the quality of police training in this state, I think, is a vital issue for us in this discussion, and we'd like to make sure that we have the opportunity to look at that as you look at the distribution that we propose for the CFA. Now, the legislature also took action regarding the collection and distribution of CFAA funds with the passage of Senate Bill 82 last session. And this legislation provided that local courts could no longer waive just the local portion of fines, but the state portion of fines, but had to waive the state and local proportionally. Now, this action did generate an expectation that CFAA revenues would grow, and that's proven to be true. The legislation that was developed at that time also put in place a system of caps on the distribution of funds to programs supported by CFAA revenues. These caps were put into place in part to provide accountability and control of agency expenditures. In the 1999 edition of this very committee, had a strong concern about how programs were funded in CFAA and a desire to provide more accountability and oversight in looking at the expenditures that are made through the programs supported by the CFAA. In fact, and Larry may recall the outcome of this, there was, I think, a budget note drafted directing the Secretary of State to perform an audit of the programs that were supported. Now, the governor didn't sign Senate Bill 82 right away. There was some considerable debate about that. When he did, he sent a letter to the Secretary of State when we filed the bill, and we provided you with a copy of that. In summary, he says that he opposed the methodology of capping programs, recognized that the potential for additional revenue, and he stated that his highest priority for funding was police training, as you look at the future. In the letter, he also committed to work on the issue through the governor's Public Safety Planning and Policy Council and with interested legislators. And at the time, it was his hope that we could create a consensus plan that would commit CFA revenue to public safety and not direct it to general other purposes. Last fall, we worked very closely with Representatives Patridge and Schrader and Westland to develop a proposal to change the distribution of the CFA funds, and we kept Senator Avell Gordley informed and involved in the progress of that project. And our objectives were to increase the accountability over CFA funding expenditures and to ensure that police training needs were adequately addressed. The result of that process was not what I would say is a consensus policy, but provided us with a consensus approach. First, the policy would end percentage distributions of the count and replace it with a budgetary process. The governor would propose a recommended budget, and the legislature would consider those priorities. The process would take place within a statutory framework that placed police training and facilities as the highest priority, victims programs as the next priority, and then it would allow funding of specific other categories of public safety activity. It was this last feature, I think, in which we had some disagreement about how that should be constructed. The proposal of other public safety programs that supports the governor's budget includes other public safety services limited to law enforcement and criminal justice grants, statewide crime investigation services, prosecution and criminal appeals assistance, law enforcement data collection and information systems, and motor vehicle traffic enforcement. Now, Representatives Patridge and Schrader have filed House Bill 2877, which would eliminate two of these other public safety services categories, and it would not allow for funding for prosecution and criminal appeals assistance, and would not allow funding of law enforcement data collection and information systems.
Can I ask you a question, Steve? Yes. Is that bill consistent with the agreement?
We didn't have an agreement on that last on that last piece, but what we did agree to is that the governor would move forward with a bill that had the five categories. Now, actually, I didn't write it in here because I thought it was confusing. We don't actually have a bill right now, so we'd either have to amend the Patridge Schrader bill or cause another bill to be introduced. And Representative Senator Minnis has said he was use a priority in the Senate if necessary to produce a bill. So,
okay, this is a House bill, and where is that? Is that bill in Ways and Means, or where is it?
No bill. I don't believe it is in Ways and Means. It may be in Judiciary Committee, I believe.
I think so. Yeah.
Likely to move? Will it come here?
I think it needs to. It needs to. Actually, that and House Bill 5010 both need to be worked here in Ways and Means. So it would be our hope that they'll both get here.
Any other questions, gentlemen? Steve, did you finish? Are you
just about?
Why don't you finish and then we'll ask questions.
Under the other public safety category in our budget, we did take the opportunity to fund three new public safety initiatives. We funded arrest and return of criminals from out of state. We funded data collection related to police stops, and we bought back the fees placed on local law enforcement for use of LEDS terminals that was placed there last session. These represent new expenditures within the CFAA. Mr. McGee will go over the budget in detail, but I just want to talk to you a little bit about the approach we had in the budget when we looked at it. Our first approach was that we were converting budget limitation into a current service budget. So we tried to identify a methodology to use the limitation to provide us with a current service budget. We then, and that, of course, would allow those programs to maintain current efforts. We did make some choices to increase funding for some programs. We did for BPSST and domestic violence programs explicitly. We added the three new program expenditures. If an existing program would no longer qualify in the future under the criteria that we established, we phased most of those programs out, though there are some slated for elimination. And we've tried to make those that remain match the criteria that we've put together. And this proposal is a pretty radical shift in state policy for distribution of the CFAA, and we recognize that. but it is, and it would put programs that have, you know, automatically enjoyed revenue streams on a two-year budget. But it might be radical for CFA, but certainly not radical for state programs overall. In the general fund, we establish budgets all the time to set our expectations and accountability for performance. The new system proposed would allow both the executive and the legislature to set priorities and ensure that programs are accountable for the expenditures. And we believe on this basis, there's serious consideration by this committee. You also have the pending choice on whether you want to make a commitment, a larger commitment, to a new DPSST facility. And that larger commitment will require additional resources out of the CFAA, both for construction of a facility and then operations into the future.
Is it the understanding that this new facility will be paid for in that manner? I know you go. It's going to take COPs and debt service and all of that, but that's going to come out of criminal fines and assessment, and not general fund.
That's what the recommendation Mr. McGee will go through and the governor put forward proposes, sir. That's brief. I think I'll just end it there, but I do just want to make the point that it will take some growth in CFAA over time to DPSST. I think the other programs that are left are, one, first in the next band will be benefited because we have some phase-outs. That will create some more room for those that fit under the policy. We expect CFAA revenue to continue to grow somewhat, and I guess as the last resort we have is now that you have the flexibility to create room in CFAA by eliminating or changing your program options. So with that, I think I'll just turn it over to Mr. McGee so he can let you know.
Steve, exactly. I don't object to that, but I do think there is a kind of anomaly because the judicial department basically is generating all of this revenue, and I think we have been here as we've dealt with their budget, just been generally embarrassed by the fact that we've given them such an inadequate budget. And I don't know, somehow or other, some attention's got to be paid. I know the governor's not responsible for them, but if somebody doesn't take the lead, they end up coming here every time with such an inadequate budget that it really is a problem. So somehow or other, that's just a system problem that needs to be dealt with.
Yes, Senator Trudeau, I want to just say that we, at a time, we explicitly considered including the judiciary in this, had some limited discussions with them early on. And at the time we were doing this, I remember editorials in the Register Guard and other, and there is a perceived conflict from CFAA revenues going directly to the judiciary. So for that reason, they're not entirely included in this proposal, although we do believe that under some public safety grants proposed here that they would be qualified for certain projects like drug courts.
I agree that there's that conflict, and I really think it's better the other way. But when they come with a budget that's so inadequate, and then they show all this money they're generating, which basically, if it were going to them, would help them with a better budget, it just makes that anomaly stand out. So we just need somehow or other, both the legislature and the governor, to work to make sure that the judicial department's better funded.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I do have a request of the committee to some extent. This is a difficult, complicated topic. It's a difficult budget. There is interest, strong interest from Patridge and Schrader representatives, from Ben Westland to some extent, Representative Peter Courtney and, Senator Courtney and Senator Minnis also have a strong interest. And we'd like to search out a way to find a process that we could actually get the involvement through maybe a work group process or something to really develop this in a way that this committee can support, that we feel good about, and they can move it forward. So I'll turn it over to Mr.
Is, are there efforts being made to do that? Mr. Nisswander, do you know if there are such efforts?
Not yet, Senator Trill, but it's probably more than likely going to happen with all the interest that there is in this measure.
Co-chairs, at least.
No discussions yet, but I think there probably will be.
Further questions, anybody, for Steve? Thank you, Steve. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services. You've got a small notebook in front of you that will contain my presentation and also some appendices that I'll mention as well. I wanted to start by giving a little background on the thermal fines and assessment and the public safety fund that we're proposing to create. Going back to the period between 1987 and 1982, after the legislature passed some modifications, the Judicial Department implemented a very major change in how financial penalties that were imposed on individuals convicted of criminal offenses, violations, or non-parking offenses are collected and distributed. As part of those changes, all fees, fines, and assessments were combined into a single financial obligation that were owed by individuals to the court upon conviction. Various special assessments supporting particular state programs were combined into the unitary assessment. A four-tiered priority system was established for the distribution of the funds. Revenues under the third tier were deposited into the criminal fines and assessment account, which is the source of funds that we're talking about today. And those CFAA revenues are distributed to a variety of programs. The programs are specified in statute. They receive a specified percentage of the CFAA revenues up to a hard dollar cap in the total amount of receipts. And just a description of that, the overall criminal offense revenue distribution system, which what I've talked about, is on the next page. And again, starts with a single financial obligation from the individual. As those monies are received, the first category is compensatory fines to victims. All money that's received is paid for those compensatory fines until that assessment is paid off. Next category is restitution to victims. The third category combines a number of different fines, fees, and assessments. There's a small injured defense payment, although I don't believe there's any money that's come in on that yet. The fines that are owed the state, forfeited bail securities, diversion fees, court costs, recouped attorney fees, unitary assessment, cost of collections, 50% of Multnomah County's parking receipts. Those Category 2 and 3 are paid off equally. Category 2 to the victims, Category 3 into the Department of Revenue until that obligation is fully paid. And the fourth category, county assessments, local split of fines, state intoxicated driver fund fees and rewards, those are paid last when all the other three categories are paid off. But focusing on the third category, as you see going down, that's transferred to the Department of Revenue. And then it is transferred into the criminal fines and assessment account, which, as I said, has statutory designated programs, percents for distributions, and hard dollar caps for total distributions. And the current programs, their percentage distributions and their caps are listed at the bottom of the page. The training account is a DPSST, a Public Safety Memorial Fund, also DPSST, and so on. And so, for example, for the first, the DPSST receives 15.1% of the fund up to a hard cap of $14.2 million. Once that amount is reached, any additional funds go into the general fund. So you see statutorily, in the second part of this bottom chart, the general fund receives about 47% of the total distribution. Given the amount of revenues in this biennium and given the caps, all programs except domestic violence will reach their caps, and the real general fund distribution here is probably closer to 58% because of the caps. So,
is there any further description of what you have to do with it once it gets to the general fund, or is it just up to
general fund? Is general fund goes with all other resources. So then, Senate Bill 82, as Steve mentioned, was a significant last year. It made a number of different changes in how courts were allowed to assess fines and assessments, and particularly to waive them or reduce them. There was a minimum fines fee schedule for convictions for traffic and other violations, with a few very specific exemptions based on some questions of justice and the person's ability to pay. The courts were prohibited from waiving the unitary assessment unless the court waived all fees of assessment. So they couldn't simply waive the unitary and then assess other fines and assessment. Any fees that were to be split between the states and the local government were required to be reduced if they were proportionately. So the state portion and the local portion would be impacted equally. And the Secretary of State and the Department of Revenue were authorized to audit any court, including justice courts, on how fines and fees were imposed. Now, that was expected to have a significant fiscal impact, and that's why the caps were established. So the additional funds that would be generated by these restrictions on how fines and fees would be assessed would be captured in the general fund. The caps were set at 10% above legislatively approved expenditure limitations for all programs except domestic violence, which established at 50% above the expenditure limitation. As I mentioned, all the recipients are expected, except domestic violence, I believe already have reached their cap or will in the next month or so for the current biennium. Based on actual receipts through February 2001, we anticipate that the general fund piece will be more than $20 million in excess of what was anticipated when the legislature went home 2 years ago. And the following chart just shows you what the monthly receipts have been.
Mr. McGee, how realistic are these caps? Are they pretty, what'd you do, some kind of a historic overview of what you thought was needed based on track record?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me first of all say this was a legislative initiative, not an executive branch initiative.
All right.
So,
how did they do it?
They did it at just setting the caps at 10% above the expenditure limitations. It was understood by all parties 2 years ago that that would probably allow the programs to operate during this biennium, although they would receive less revenue than they would have otherwise. It was also understood that most of these programs, particularly ones like DPSST that have some need to grow given legislative direction, would not be able to continue to operate in future biennia, and that the cap issue would have to be addressed again. It was believed
the idea that the cap issue would be addressed this session or after this session?
This session. This is now statutory, so there has to be a change in law to change the caps at this point.
Yeah, if I could add to part of the rationale from the legislative perspective was that by putting the caps in place, the revenue wouldn't go to each of those recipients, and then at this biennium, at this discussion, at this session, would be a taking away from them, if you will. It went to the general fund, and the governor's budget relies on it, and that sets the stage for them living with the budgeted amounts that we're able to describe to you in this process. So the revenue, that $20 million would have been distributed instead of being in the general fund.
So page 6 just simply shows you the growth in revenue. When we left the session, the overall amount that was expected to be received in this fund was about $82.9 million. We're projecting that we'll actually see about $110.1 total. That includes the general fund piece and the agency pieces. And the projections in the governor budget for 2001-2003 are that there'll be about $114.3 million available. So there's been significant growth to date in this program. So that's a little bit of the background. The governor's proposal is built on two pieces of legislation. As Steve mentioned, House Bill 2877 with the amendments that we would propose to support the governor's budget, and House Bill 5010, which allocates the revenues based on the statutory changes in 2877. So let me starting at page 8, take you through the two pieces of legislation and explain what the governor is proposing. House Bill 2877, which is Representative Patrick and Schrader's bill, with the amendments that would return it to the proposal the governor is suggesting, would eliminate the statutory distributions, the percentages, and the caps. It would establish a criminal fines and assessment public safety fund. It would establish criteria for programs to be funded from the public safety fund in a priority order. Steve took you through those a minute ago. I'll just reference them again. The first priority is public safety training and facilities. The second is criminal injuries compensation and the assistance to victims of crime. And the third are other public safety services with the five specific areas mentioned below as limitations. Law enforcement criminal justice systems grant, statewide crime investigation services, prosecution and criminal appeals assistance, law enforcement data collection information systems, and commercial vehicle traffic enforcement. 2877 would defer specific program decisions and funding levels to be determined by the governor and the legislature through the budget process. For the 2001-2003 biennium, 42% of the criminal fines and assessment account is proposed to be allocated to the public safety fund, with the remaining 58% transferred to the general fund. In subsequent biennia, with our amendments to 2877, we propose that the split between the public safety fund and the general fund would be determined by the governor and the legislature through the budget process again. So page 10 gives you just a visual display of the changes we're proposing, laid over the same thing we looked at a few minutes earlier. So the top of the chart is the same in terms of the four categories for the financial obligation. But as the criminal fines and assessment fund runs through the Department of Revenue, it's split into two components. The general fund component, which again in 2001-2003 would be 58% of the total, set to any general fund uses that the legislature determines. And in future biennia, the split between general fund and the criminal fines and assessment public safety fund would be determined by the legislature. And the criminal fines assessment public safety fund, again, 42% next biennium, determined by the legislature in future biennium, with program allocations made according to the three criteria that we've discussed. That's our statutory proposal. Going along with that is House Bill 5010, which is a budget bill, which is currently assigned to the Ways and Means Committee, but not assigned to the subcommittee. That actually allocates the revenues from the Criminal Fines and Assessment Public Safety Fund.
Yes, Mr. Nicewender, does LFO find any problem with this model for distribution?
Chair Trill, committee members, LFO, on behalf of myself, Paul Siebert, and Robin Lamont, all participated in the interim work group, so we are aware of the provisions that have come forward. We participated fully in that. We supported the idea of going to a budget model versus a hard percent model for purposes of the fact that then you make a conscious decision of what programs get what. That also sets aside the amount of revenue necessary to fund the highest priorities. In this case, the public safety training program and facilities have yet to be able to be fully funded, and this will provide a means for that to occur. So in short, yes, we supported the concept.
You were involved in
it. We were involved in it. I think, and what Steve's testified to is this reflects the work of that work group with probably two or three exceptions, and those are some things that they had to add on to the funding stream during Governor's recommended budget development.
Questions, anybody?
Okay, I'll move on to page 11 then and just summarize again the budget allocations the governor is proposing from this fund. As we mentioned, we do increase the funding for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for operations and debt service on the new facility, the Department of State Police Commercial Vehicle Traffic Enforcement, and the Domestic Violence Fund. Steve mentioned there's new allocations for race-based policing studies, for the law enforcement data systems operations, and for the Arrest and Return of Fugitives program. We have specific allocations at current levels for regional assessment centers, child abuse medical assessments, and the Department of State Police training. Previously, all three of those programs have been funded with CFAA, but they were within other distributions, so they weren't clearly articulated as choices that have been made. We're making those clearly in the budget bill this time, so the choices to fund them are unambiguous. We're phasing out allocations to the Intoxicated Driver Program, which is in the Department of Human Services, the Safety Education Fund in the Department of Transportation, the Children's Trust Endowment Fund, and the Emergency Medical Enhancement Account, which is transferred to the Health Division and the Oregon Health Sciences University. We're continuing the Public Safety Memorial Fund.
Will those things that are phased out be funded some other way?
We are proposing funding for them in the 2001-2003 biennia, in some cases at a reduced level. The expectation is that they would not be funded beyond that, and that would be an issue for the future governors and legislatures to determine if they chose to continue funding.
Now, those that are being phased out will still be funded with criminal fines and assessment money.
In the 2001-2003 biennia. There's a specific exemption in 2877 that allows the legislature to fund programs that don't meet the criteria for 2001-2003, but then removes that allowance. So limited into the purposes beginning in 2003, 2005.
So if those programs are going to exist into the future beyond the biennium we're budgeting for, something has to be done.
There would need to be budget choices made.
Is LFO doing anything about that?
The only thing I qualify with that was of those things that are being eliminated, I believe there's seven of them. This isn't the sole source of funding for five of them, or at least four of them. So there are some other revenue sources that do support them. It is probably going to be a matter of discussion in the next budget cycle as to whether they continue funding and would probably be competing with other agencies for general fund dollars.
Nothing specifically during the interim will be done to study the problem.
There's nothing planned at this point. These are relatively small amounts with a couple exceptions. I think in order to stop one of them, I believe we'd have to have a statutory change, and that's the intoxicated driver program. So there will be subsequent discussions.
Okay. Questions, folks?
Okay. On page 12, the Public Safety Memorial Fund and DPSST, the Criminal Injuries Compensation Account, Department of Justice, State Police Forensics and Information Systems programs, the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account, or CAMI, and the State Office for Services and Children and Family, and the Sexual Assault Victims Fund, also in the State Office for Services to Children and Families, are continued at current level. The expenditure limitations are included in the agency budget bills, and a detailed budget spreadsheet is on the next two pages, which is organized by department and with program within that. It shows you the allocation that we are proposing as part of the governor's revised budget, the expenditure limitations that would support it. It shows you the carryover balance that these programs have to begin the 2001-2003 biennium, and we are including those as part of the funding to support the expenditure limitations. We also show you in these tables the statutory percentages, the dollar caps that were established in Senate Bill 82, and the expenditure limitations that were established in the 99-2001 legislatively adopted budget. That's my formal presentation. The notebook you have also has a section with the current statutory language regarding unitary assessment for criminal fines and assessment account. It has a copy of House Bill 2877 with our proposed amendments to it, a copy of House Bill 5010 with our proposed amendments to it, and a very brief program description for each of the programs that are currently funded or we're proposing to fund.
Oh, go ahead, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are either of you aware of the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention folks' concerns regarding, at least the concern that they gave to me was that the ORS that's listed in the budget bill doesn't include for the ORS for regional services?
If I may address that, we've met with those folks, and we believe that we have we've addressed most of their questions. Let me tell you how.
Okay.
If you see the spreadsheet on page 13, about three quarters of the way down, you get a child abuse multidisciplinary intervention account. When we met with them, they had a number of issues. The first suggestion they made to us that we had underestimated the amount of money that required to continue them at current service level. We met with the department, we looked at that, we agreed with them and determined that we needed to add another $800,000. So as part of the governor's revised budget, we've increased the funding for that by $800,000 and reduced the debt service by DPSST, as we'll talk to you about when we do their budget a little bit later. The next issue that they had was that the regional assessment centers were unfunded. It was never our intention to do that. So if you'll see the line right below the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention, there is a line item for the regional assessment centers. That is funded. We worked with the State Office for Service and Children and Families, and we believe we funded that again at current level. And SCF tells us we've done that, that both of these programs are funded at current levels, and they are continued. I suspect the CAMI people will continue to be concerned about funding in 03-05, both the fact that they had a very large carryover. They had about a $4.1 million carryover going into this biennium, and we've assumed that that doesn't keep carrying over, but that they'll spend that, and then that in future biennium that they will be allocated the amount of money they need to support the program. And they don't have a guaranteed revenue source anymore, and I'm sure that's a concern for them too, but that's part of the proposal. So we think we've addressed the most serious issues they've talked about, except for guaranteed future funding.
Mr. Chair, one more issue that they brought to my attention, and I don't know if it's been addressed yet. I think under Section 7 is what they identified for me on on House Bill 5010, the criminal injuries compensation account.
Mm-hmm.
They indicated that that didn't include, or they believe it didn't include, a mechanism for payment for medical exams relates to child abuse.
Child abuse medical. That was very similar to the regional assessment. It was never our intent to not fund that. So again, if you look at sort of the top of the chart under Department of Justice, we have identified the child abuse medical assessments as a particular line item. We funded that at the current level. Department of Justice agrees we funded it at the current level. And in our amendments to House Bill 5010, which are in your folder, we do have the specific language that authorized those funding. So there'll be no ambiguity that those two items are taken care of.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Okay, Mr. Nussman, or anything?
Yes, just one other thing that Robin reminded me. In our discussions over this concept, the only thing that we didn't do or didn't go far enough to do we would have supported would have been actually leaving all this money in the general fund and then having it all be subject to the same level of competition that all other general fund agencies and programs compete for. It still maintains a dedicated funding source for the programs that are listed. But that was one of the concepts we talked about.
But you opted for this one instead.
This was the consensus of the work group. Representative Traders here, when they're done, he wanted to speak a couple minutes.
Okay. Are you finished? Do you want to call him?
If there's any questions.
Any questions for the gentleman? Representative Schrader would like to testify, we're going to ask him to come in.
While he's coming up, we just wanted you to get this overview today because DPSST's budget's the next one up. It's a major recipient of this revenue source. You will be, if you haven't already been, talked about. Many of people will be talking to you about this funding source and the changes that are being proposed. Robin just checked for me, and House Bill 2877 is in House Judiciary, but it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So, the other bill is here, although they aren't assigned yet, I fully expect that this subcommittee will probably be the one that will deal with these issues. So, this overview is very timely.
Representative Schrader, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I served in the Public Safety Ways and Means Subcommittee last session, and CFAA unitary assessment allocations and account were a big topic of discussion. And a lot of our discussion, I think, was the result of some earlier concerns, previous legislatures, about this account and how the money was collected at the local level, quite frankly, whether or not judges were actually assessing this. And you heard some testimony today already about that being an issue. I would suggest this committee continue to investigate that. There apparently, despite the legislative direction, the statute, and even direction from last session, there is still apparently some question in some of the judicial minds as to exactly what do they have to do or do not, what is their discretion and what is not. I think as you've seen and was alluded to by the governor's office and DAS that they are getting better at collecting and assessing these fines. And these fines are important because they do help pay for police and public safety training, and they do compensate victims of some of the crimes that we see out there. So that uniformity should be reaffirmed. I would suggest that this uniformity be reaffirmed by this committee, this subcommittee, this session. That was indeed one of the major charges that we talked about but did not probably resolve during the interim. Because of our interest, I served on a work group with Representative Westland, who was chair of public safety last time, Representative Patridge and myself, along with DAS and LFO. To talk about some of these issues. The idea of the caps that had come up before was of concern to many of the participants in the program. And it became an issue, if you will, with the legislature also. On the one hand, the caps didn't allow good programs that had extraordinary needs or expenses that the legislature might think need to be funded to be funded. It because of the cap. And on the other hand, there were those accounts that were accumulating seemingly large balances based on the percentage allocations for which the legislature, again, had no control or no understanding of why and how this was going on, and perhaps, again, at the detriment of some other more worthwhile programs. I would suggest that all the people that are involved in unitary assessment at this present time are doing very, very good work and have great ideas for how they can improve upon some of their mission. But it became apparent to the legislature that there was not a lot of checks and balances in the system to kind of make sure that they were going down the road that was generally thought of as appropriate by the legislature and, frankly, some of the departments in the governor's office. So it became thoughtful. We thought at that time that maybe we should have a discussion about how best to allocate those resources in a fairer manner. The work group met several times during the interim. There was a lot of very good discussion. I thought a lot of agreement as we went through the process. You're going to hear from a lot of the stakeholders about the relative worth of some of our recommendations. We tried to come up with something we thought was a very balanced approach. There was discussion about the relative allocations. The caps were not popular with the stakeholders. They became fairly unpopular with the legislators that were dealing with it for the reasons I stated. And we looked at various ways of dealing with this, and we came down to a budget model, much like we do for all the other agencies that you've seen and we'll see for the rest of the legislature. They should come in, make their case. They would have a current service level roll up from session to session, if you will, albeit within the CFAA account as opposed to the general fund account. And then make their case to you that they needed more money for regional assessment centers, they needed more money for a training facility, or whatever the case might be. And then you and your infinite wisdom would, of course, see the light and allocate appropriately, and things would go on and be fine. There is some concern. Certainly it is a little more discretionary. The legislature has more discretion then to kind of help shape their budget a little bit, give them direction. And I think that is the concern that a lot of the stakeholders have. It's an obvious one. I'd have that too. And they'll be testifying as to, you know, how comfortable they are with some of these. I think the DAS and the governor's office gave a pretty good presentation. There, one of the major issues I guess I would suggest you look into at this point in time is how this very limited resource is to be allocated. There is a difference between the legislative and executive perspective on that. One of the budget process models that we worked on was Model 3B, and it talked about a more limited definition, if you will, of public safety. One of the big concerns that legislators had was this was basically a new pork barrel funding source. If you couldn't get something funded through the general fund, you would go to the Unitary Assessment Fund and see if you could get money out of that to fund your favorite program. And unfortunately, that came at the expense of criminal victims, the CAMI people, and frankly, DPSST, the public safety training facility.
Sorry, Kurt, you said what people?
Excuse me, the CAMI people, the child abuse multidisciplinary team. You guys don't have the fine jar here, so I guess
I thought you
okay.
Said CAMI people.
Yeah, right.
How did you get that in there?
Pretty good. So the idea that kind of resonated with a lot of us, that, you know, it shouldn't be just the latest, greatest idea, and I've got a project back home, and I want to fund it, and general fund's tight, so let's go look at unitary assessment. So one of our missions, I thought, and I think Representative Patridge, Representative Westland, same thing, was that we were going to tighten up the definition of who could access this account. Otherwise, as LFO has stated, why even have this account? Why don't we just throw it all in at the general fund if it's going to be just like any other budgetary source? So there was a lot of agreement that in our work group, at least, that DPSST was probably the top priority and should have priority access to the dollars. There was a difference of opinion as to how much of a training facility we needed. The $85 million that's being proposed, I think, or at this, well, actually, we don't even have a figure, as you know. We don't have a location, so we don't really have a definition of what we need. So this group needs to be thinking about that as you go through this process. But there was a lot of concern in our committee that the $85 million figure was quite high compared to what we thought was necessary. And there are problems in that whole issue. It was supposed to be a complete training facility. We're trying to get our people up to, you know, the 20 or 24 weeks that other states are doing in terms of training, and we're woefully below that, unfortunately. Our goal was 16 weeks, but others are way ahead of us at this point in time. So we need a facility, but there's another issue where certain jurisdictions prefer not to participate. Oregon State Police want to participate only to a certain point. They have their own training facility. Portland, I believe, has its own training facility. I think Eugene, Springfield want to do their own thing. So it gets, you need to decide, well, geez, you know, why are we doing this, and what exactly is this facility going to do that the others can't, so there's no duplication of effort. So there was concern about the total amount, and I think that'll be a discussion, broader discussion we'll have in the legislature, and certainly you in this subcommittee. The other issue that is a little bit of a difference between the legislative and executive view of this particular project is the type of programs, if you will. The top priority, as I said, was the DPSST. There was fairly general agreement there. I feel there was pretty good agreement on a second tier, which included the criminal injuries compensation account, the child abuse multidisciplinary teams, domestic violence program, and the sexual assault victims. Those all were very clearly victim type of restitution programs that we agreed on. Where we got hung up with, and we also agreed, frankly, and this is certainly a topic of discussion, there's certain things that really shouldn't be in here, and I think you heard from the governor's office that they will be given their allocation during this biennium, but probably phased out and forced to look for themselves for their own resources in the future. But then there were a number of others where they had historically been on the program, like the Oregon State Police Forensic Analysis, Commercial Truck Program, the info services, that sort of thing, and we at this point felt that that could probably continue. But our goal was, after the victim's assistant and DPSST, to find a more narrow definition of who should be in this account as opposed to being in the general fund or in some other budget of some other major agency. And we had a little trouble getting to that bottom line, to be quite frank. And my concern is not quite in agreement with some of the new additions that the governor's office has put forward. At no point did we discuss the LEDS program being in this budget. At no point did we discuss the arrest and fugitive return being in this budget. And at no point did we discuss that the race profiling study be a portion of this budget. Those are all new things that the governor is bringing forward as something to consider this time. But it should be clear to this committee that that was not part of our discussion. I personally have some concerns about that because, I thought our whole mission was to get away from adding too many things in here, and I would urge this committee to think of a very strict definition that makes this worthwhile having or being a separate budgetary source at this point in time. So the overall bill, though, I think is good. It was to address a problem of, I think, several biennia. Generally, I would concur with the 58%, 42% of this session. I would also think it might be something we'd want to revisit as far as the actual percentages in the future biennium, and certainly every legislature has that option anyway. But the big issues for you are to, in my opinion, or I would appreciate being addressed, would be the judges and the discretion or not in terms of assessing these fines, whether or not we want to limit the definition here a little bit of what should go in this criminal fines and assessment account, or be funded out of this account, and then lastly, look closely at the training facility itself and make sure that we make good long-term decisions that are prudent fiscally and enable public safety to do its job. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Other questions? Go ahead.
I'm Representative Schrader. I appreciate your presentation. It's real helpful to have a better context. I'm a little unclear about the point you've made with regard to judges having some discretion. Are you talking about the unitary assessment, that part, or I'm unclear what,
right,
exactly what it is you're saying?
And others can speak to this more knowledgeably than I. There had been, and that was alluded to by Mr. McGee, I believe, there had been some discretion in the past or some feeling on the part of many of the municipal judges, particularly that when they had a traffic citation that they were issuing, part of that goes to, they're supposed to be adding on this unitary assessment when they give that fine. And many judges would either not have them pay the penalty or waive the fine or waive the state portion of the fine. It goes into a couple of different accounts. They'd have great latitude as to whether or not they were going to even assess these fines as part of the overall ticket, if you will, that the person had or penalty that the person had.
Mr. Chair, if I, so let's say the judge fines somebody $100. You're saying that above that there's a unitary assessment fee that should have been as part of the judgment, that the judge took the 100 but didn't assess the...
Right. My understanding, and I'm more than willing to be corrected, statutorily they're required not just to assess the 100 but also the state and local portion of the unitary assessment.
They weren't doing that?
That is correct.
And how can they do that statutory if they're directed by statute?
Well, there was, it's how you read the statutes, I think. And I don't think they certainly don't, I don't want to impugn the judicial system at all. They were reading it to the best of what they thought the intent was, and legislature has thought otherwise, at least up till this point. And there was some more direction given statutorily to say, yes, you must assess these fines. If you assess a fine, you must assess the unitary assessment also. But then during the interim, there was a little bit of discussion that even that was slightly unclear. I guess I'd have LFO answer more detail, or again, people more
knowledgeable. That's helpful. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, and I follow up. Also, Brad Swank is here too. I may have Brad come up if we continue in this question area. There was some requirements provided last session that if they were going to waive it, they would waive it uniformly, not just waive the state's portion. And also, this last interim, Secretary of State's office has done an audit of a sampling of the courts to find out just how the money was being collected and distributed in accordance with the statute. And we were hopeful that that report would be available during session so that we could have some more information about that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very
much. Thank you. Good luck.
Right. Mr. Nicewander, do you want us to take any further action on this?
Nothing necessary today. Just know that the bills will be here, and we will have future opportunity to address them. We can start the DPSST presentation.
Welcome, Diane.
Sure. While they're coming up to the table, I just wanted to give you, I put in front of you today a couple handouts to give you the background information on this agency budget. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, opening day, they'll be in here today, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. If all goes well, we should be able to complete their presentation and work session. This is a budget that is entirely funded with other funds and federal funds. There is a significant increase proposed in their budget this biennium, and you see the growth from 9901 to governor's recommended for other funds. And they'll talk about this being about a 60% increase. A lot of that is debt service for a proposed facility that they'll talk to you about. And as already been talked about today, there is the cost of expanding the training program or driving the cost, as well as facility, staff, equipment. They'll talk about that as they talk about their budget. In terms of breaking their budget down, they've got five budget units, the largest of which is the Criminal Justice Training and Certification Unit. It's got also 85% of the FTE and about 88% of the funding. Beyond that, they have fire certification training, private security, and the Public Safety Memorial Fund. And then this is the first biennium where they have a capital construction limitation. When they were here 2 years ago, they were given two budget notes, and I've given you a handout that have those outlined for you. One was dealing with the ability to expand. This what last biennium was the second biennium that the direction was given to them to try and reach the 16-week training program for basic police, but due to revenue shortages and facility limitations, they weren't able to do that. The budget note was written to in hopes that if there was additional revenue, at the time the budget was reviewed, there were changes being discussed in the criminal fines and assessment account, and the outcome of that was unknown. And so in order to cover that contingency, the budget note was written. As it turns out, there wasn't additional revenue nor facilities to get there. They were directed to develop a facilities plan. They are in the process of doing that, and they have reported to the emergency board on that plan at least twice in the interim. They have received at this point from the emergency board about $400,000 in expenditure limitation to do siting evaluation and planning development, in addition to the $250,000 that was put in their budget 2 years ago. They can talk to you as a part of their budget presentation as to where they are. The emergency board had several requests of them as they developed their proposal, and I've outlined those in your handout there as well. And they'll talk about giving you a status report update on where they are in those as well. I also need to point out that during the interim, there was a Legislative Council Administrative Rule Review report that cited some findings related to where council believed that the rules were outside the intent of the enabling legislation. And I have a report from the department that confirms that they have, in fact, addressed each of those findings. Any questions?
In what sense were they outside of the intent and scope of enabling legislation?
I've asked them to speak to that. I think it had to do with whether or not exemptions to the statute that were cited in the rules applied, a fee, whether or not they had the authority to establish a fee for certification. But each of those were either addressed by rule revisions or statutory changes.
Okay, so they've all been taken care of?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Any other questions? Mr. Nicewinder. Okay, proceed, Diane.
Good morning, Chair Tro, members of the committee. I'm Diane Middle, the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And we have in your notebooks a copy of this morning's testimony. However, I won't follow it verbatim to spare you, but we'll give you an overview of the agency, our mission, our goals, and give you a little historical perspective, because I think that's helpful in understanding some of the decision-making process that we're going through right now. The mission of the agency is to promote excellence in all public safety through training and quality training, as well as through standards. We do now have responsibility for the certification and the training of all disciplines, so that includes your law enforcement police people, both city and county police officers, your firefighters, both your career and volunteer, your parole and probation officers, corrections officers, both county and state, your telecommunicators, 911 dispatchers, and emergency medical dispatchers. And we also have private security, and I hope I haven't missed anybody in that. The reason I point that out is because we have gone through a great deal of growth, and that's pretty much what puts us where we are today. When the agency was created, which is back in 1961, it was the Board on Police Standards and Training at that point in time. It was initially designed for training and certification of law enforcement personnel only. We had a constituent base of about 2,500. At about the time we moved to Western Oregon University, which is where we're currently located, it was still the police academy at that point in time, and we had about 3,600 constituents that we had responsibility for. Over time, we had the polygraph licensing added to our constituent base. We had tribal police, railroad police, port police, your state parole and probation was added. We added legislatively the responsibility for leadership training, which is the supervision, management, and executive level for all the disciplines. In 89, we had state corrections added, which was a very big increase. And in 91, and what you'll see here is in kind of the last 10 years is a very big increase. By 91, which was 10 years ago, we were up to 7,200 constituents. And then we added the telecommunicators, we added the certification of state police, Black Butte and Sun River, which are special police districts. We then added the fire service in 93, private security in 95, and then by 97, DPSST had really grown. It was now changed from the police standards and training to public safety, and then became the department, which was still supported by a board which sets the standards which we, in fact, apply and enforce.
Diane, were all these additions authorized by the legislature?
They were all legislative additions. That's correct. Thank you. So today our constituent base is in excess of 32,000. We are still at our same location at Western Oregon University, and that's what's created the challenges, and that's why you've heard some early testimony this morning about why we are in pursuit of a new facility. One of the other things that occurred also, and that was mentioned earlier this morning, was in 1997, the legislature acknowledged that we were, in particular in law enforcement training, very far behind the national curve and really were not meeting the goals necessary for the requirements of law enforcement in this day and age. as it relates to training, and it was recommended that we get to 16 weeks of training. Well, as you can tell by the growth and the fact that we were in the same facilities, that presented quite a challenge. We have been able to get to 10 weeks of training, but because of the facility's limitations, we cannot get to 16 weeks of training. So we have been working on that facility's issue. Along with that, we have looked at, beyond just building a facility, are there other ways to deliver training? Well, we know from our experience with fire service and from our experience with maintenance training for law enforcement that we can do some of that training regionally. What we have discovered, though, is that basic training requires a fair amount of continuity. It also requires a considerable amount of oversight, and it also requires facilities and training equipment, which are very difficult to replicate throughout the communities, which would create an additional expense. But there are some things that we do which can be delivered regionally, which can be delivered through distance learning, and other alternative methods. So we have been exploring that throughout this biennium. And I'll go into more detail on that when we get into the detailed presentation. But we have looked at all of those. The other thing we did was because we knew that law enforcement had changed so drastically and what communities were expecting from their officers had changed, we knew we had to train differently. We also knew that our constituents were telling us that the officers that were coming from the academy were not ready to do their job the way the community needed them. So we stepped back and we had a number of advisory groups come in and look at how we train and how we teach. And we now teach in what we refer to as a theme-enhanced scenario-based method. What this requires is that we went back and looked at all the things that comprise what a law enforcement officer does. And of course, there's the usual things you would expect. They need to know the law, they need to know the various skills, their firearms, their defensive tactics, those kinds of things. But beyond that, they needed to be good communicators. They needed to understand all areas of communication so that if you were working with a person who was hearing impaired, that you would need to be able to know how to communicate. If they spoke another language, you needed to be able to communicate. If they suffered from some mental or emotional disabilities, you needed to know how to communicate. So we looked at that as very much at something we needed to be training. We looked at issues of ethics, and we looked at issues of diversity, and we looked at issues of health and fitness. And we came up with seven themes that really molded what made a good law enforcement officer. What we did then is took our traditional training and said, how do we get an officer to understand that in the work that they're doing and in the decision making that they're doing? And so we created what's called an adult learning model, which is scenario-based training. So while we give them a concept, we then make them demonstrate through going through scenarios and problem solving that they can apply all those thought processes, all of those themes, and therefore we create an officer that can think and that can respond in multitudes of different circumstances. We found this to be incredibly beneficial, so beneficial that the rest of our disciplines are wanting their curriculum done in that format as well, and so we're beginning to go in that route.
And is that done nationally as well, other places where they train people?
Senator Trow, it is beginning to be done nationally. Right now, we are one of the states that is the model for this process. We did go and learn from other states that were doing portions of this, but we looked at kind of the best around the country and then brought it back to Oregon and created our model that molded the best of those features into this model. The other part of when we do training is that we have to make sure that there is a level of consistency because, as you know, all of these disciplines are subject to a great deal of scrutiny in the courts. We have to make sure that anything we train and any standard we set is defensible and it's verifiable. So what that means is we have gone to a network of committees that view every piece of curriculum we do and every standard that we set to make sure it meets those needs, which means it also needs to be flexible for every time there's a law change or a new court ruling. We have to be adaptable to that. What it also meant that as we started doing things in a regional basis, when Portland and Eugene did their pilot programs, when we were going through our backlog and trying to get training caught up, we had to make sure that when they trained and met the state standards so that when officers were brought into a court in a civil litigation for abuse of force or whatever, and the agency was called in to ask, what is the standard, what is the recommended procedure, we need to be very certain that officers were trained the same thing throughout the state and that, in fact, it was the most current standard. That's what brings in our regulatory side, which is our standard and certification side, which you don't hear as much about as our training side, but is every bit as important to the overall picture of the agency. Now, the agency is organized, obviously operationally and then also budgetarily. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training works very, very closely with the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and that executive committee. The board is made up of 23 constituents that are selected by the governor and go through Senate confirmation. They, as I indicated, represent each of our disciplines. There's also an executive committee, which is made up of the chairperson of each of the advisory committees. The advisory committees are a network of individuals who represent each of the specific disciplines. And that has occurred because as we have grown, while the board provides good oversight and continuity, there was a feeling that individual disciplines were not always having their needs met and that there was still enough difference between the public safety disciplines that it was important that they had a forum that we could hear their concerns as it related to police, as it related to corrections. The executive committee provides some continuity. So when the advisory committees make a recommendation of a standard change or a policy change, it then goes to the executive committee and they confirm as to whether that has impact on any of the other disciplines. And that gives us a level of continuity before we create any new policies or standards that we are not inadvertently impacting another discipline, but there is continuity wherever possible.
Is that working successfully?
It's working very well. And in fact, there is some legislation pending this session, House Bill 2944, I believe, that will actually put that in formal process. It has worked, from my perspective, extremely well. They are a tremendous asset to me as a resource in decision-making for the agency as a whole, and especially as to each of the individuals' disciplines, since we have become so complex.
Will you, as you create your new facility, will you involve these committees to make sure that the facility is friendly to what they need to do?
Senator Trow, they are very much involved, I think sometimes more than they choose to be with the number of meetings that we have, but they are very much involved, and in fact, we have on the facility committee, we have a series of committees that are working on that as well as regular communication with the advisory committees and the boards. We have a core facility group that's made up of a single representative of each of the disciplines and then the steering committee, which is a larger, more geographic location dealing with both the rural and the urban interests in each of the disciplines as well. So it's a fairly complex interaction.
Representative Smith has a question.
I fully support this facility, but I do have one question. In front of me, I have unemployment data for the state of Oregon, and when I go down these numbers, I can go to Harney County and see 18% unemployment, or Jefferson County with 12.4%, or Wallowa County with 19%. Was any consideration given to, in the siting of this, to place this facility in a community that was distressed and could benefit tremendously from the jobs that would be created or transferred as a result of this facility?
Senator Representative Smith, a great deal of consideration was given to each of the items that you mentioned. One of our biggest challenges is the way we do training and operate is we don't actually have full-time instructors on staff. We rely on a pool of about 350 part-time trainers that are actually employees of the public safety agencies located around the academy. Without them, we would not be able to do the amount of training that we do at the academy, and that's predominantly the law enforcement corrections community that I'm talking about at this point in time. Our concern was that we would not have an adequate pool or a means of getting those people to that location. But the point that you make, and part of the reason that we looked at having a core facility which is distinct from a centralized facility, is that the Corps would take care of those programs which are too difficult to transport, but then you would be able to provide regional training throughout the area. We now in our, we anyway, so knowing that we had that instructor issue, we focused primarily, which is where 78% of those instructors come from, as well as about 78% of the students. Because operationally, it would be a huge challenge to try and do it in any of those more remote areas and get instructors and staff and the students there. Within our the four finalist groups that we're looking at, I think we probably have three communities that meet some of those same criteria, that being Monmouth, where we're currently located, but is also a very rural community with some economic challenges, Sweet Home and Scappoose, and then we have one state-owned piece of property, which is in Salem.
Representative Smith, go ahead.
I guess when I look at these unemployment numbers, I look at Jefferson County, that's at almost 13%, and that's not within my district, although I have eight counties. And that's centrally located in the center of the state. And to me, it seems like, granted, 70-some-odd percent are within the I-5 corridor, but we still have folks from throughout the whole state, and maybe a central location would make sense. The folks from Baker County, when they want to come over, have to travel 6 or 7 hours. Perhaps we could accommodate the whole state and have a central location.
Senator Trow, Representative Smith, we actually did have a submittal from the Redmond Madras area, and again, our challenge was how do we get enough instructors there? It's a beautiful location. I would not object to it in the least, and it is centrally located, but we did take a look at what happens is that because our instructors come from local agencies, one of our biggest challenges, even right now at 10 weeks, is making sure we have an instructor in every classroom because they get called away for court, they get held over on shifts, and those kinds of things. And that would strap us even further as we go to 16 weeks. It would strap us even further the farther we get away from that pool, is be able to have a backup and actually keep instructors in the classroom and keep the program going, because my
dilemma though is I've got counties in Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon that have high unemployment rates and folks without jobs. And this is the type of project that would be a tremendous economic boost to a small town in Jefferson County. Folks would come, they would travel, they would use Main Street services, they would stay in the local hotels, they'd eat at the local restaurants. And I think one job that's incumbent upon us is to find those areas throughout the state, whether it's in inner city Portland or in rural Oregon, and say what can we do to help them benefit from state development. I think this is one such project. Now, with that said, again, I fully support this project, but I really hope the committee will take that into consideration and try and look for those communities that want this type of development and could accommodate this type of development.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Why don't you proceed, Diane?
Okay, let's see. Fairly well-covered organization a little bit, because I'm going to talk about the reorganization we did too, but from a budget perspective, we do have five budget structures that you'll be hearing more about. That's our 010, which is our criminal justice and certification. That funding source you've already heard a little bit about today, which is the criminal fines and assessment account. It also has within it our telecommunicators and emergency medical dispatchers. They are funded from the 911 excise tax. And we will, there are two bills pending right now that would remove the sunset clause from that, because otherwise that funding would go away this session. So we're hoping that one of those bills will pass to be able to continue that funding source and that program. 020 is our fire training and certification funding source, and that is the fire insurance premium tax. And as you'll hear a little bit later in the presentation, that one too is reaching its limits of what it can fund. 030 is private security. That is completely fee-based from those being licensed. 040 is the memorial fund that provides benefits to the survivors of officers killed or permanently disabled in the line of duty, and that is also from the criminal fines and assessment account. And then the 089, which we hope will be the major construction funding source. We basically have, at this point in time, 97.62 full-time employees. In that picture, though, there are 21 of those positions are what pay for the basically 190 to 350 instructors that it takes at any given time to make the programs work. So it's divided between multiple people. In the governor's recommended budget, there is the request to take us to 109 full-time employees, and that can be seen in more detail to Exhibit B, and we'll talk about that in more detail a little bit later. We have gone through significant reorganization, and that began in 1998. What we did as an agency is took a look at how we're doing business now and how we could do it more efficiently. And one of the key things was to get all of our people doing similar functions together. What we had was a series of fairly disjointed teams. In other words, we had academy training over here, and then we had people that were doing regional training over here, and the two might never communicate, but at the same time, they would be using the same instructors, they would want to be using the same equipment, they would from time to time be scheduling the same spaces, and there wasn't communication. So we grouped everything related to training into one group under a training division director. We took our standards and certification, whether it was fire, whether it was private security, whether it was law enforcement, and put it all together under a standard and certification director. We now have continuity, and not only that, but we have the ability for the training division to work very, very closely with the standard and certification division so that one isn't making changes that the other one doesn't know about and that we lose sync. And when we lose sync, that's when we raise the risk of liability to the agencies that we serve. So they do now work in sync. One of the goals of our constituents was to have a central record repository, and we're getting very close to having that for them. We also worked through our strategic business plan to create our goals for the future, and that was done with the help of our constituents. It was done through local focus groups, as you'll recall, and it got us to focusing on the fact that we needed to have training not only to get us to the 16 weeks of law enforcement, but to improve our corrections training and our parole and probation training and our telecommunicators, but it was also to make sure we were on track with regional delivery and that we were focusing at alternatives. We looked at short-term and long-term facilities, as you're aware, and we'll talk about that some more, and we looked at another key issue, which is the instructor development, to be able to support all those programs. The major impacts that we've had over the past couple of years or few years has been the increase in constituents, very definitely, both by the legislature, but then also by the agencies themselves. As each prison came online, that added additional correctional officers. We've accommodated that training by taking some of that regionally, which we were able to do because corrections is a much shorter class and is not as equipment intensified as law enforcement is. We had trainings at Treasure Valley Community College, Blue Mountain Community College, and those are primarily the two that we did. The other thing that we did to take care of the backlogs and with the growth of constituents was we helped Eugene and Portland carry on basic training at both of their locations, which they have done successfully. You may recall that Portland had a period of time where they were attempting to hire 80 officers all at once. For us, that would be two complete classes. We did begin doing more training than we ever had before. Typically, we would have one law enforcement class in session and maybe a corrections class. We went to routinely having two law enforcement classes in session, sometimes as much as three, at least two corrections classes in session at one time, sometimes more if we were doing a regional. We would then typically have a parole and probation or a dispatcher telecom class in session, or we would have a management leadership class in session at any one time. We went to doing shifts so that we were using the facility in the evenings, which actually worked for some of our instructors fairly well. And we took every ounce of space we could find, any place in the greater Monmouth to Corvallis area to train people. We rented virtually every room we could or borrowed it to make it happen, including our basements and everything else. Senate Bill 1145 from a couple sessions ago also impacted us as it related to parole and probation. It changed the way they did their jobs and required us to redo training. It also required for many agencies the additions of firearms training, which had not been included as a part of their program. Adding fire service also increased our training responsibilities, and as I indicated, most of that is done regionally. In Oregon, between 70% and 80% of our firefighters are volunteers, so we do need to provide training evenings and weekends, which is what we do. The reorganization has provided, as I indicated, a lot of efficiencies. We've also been able to do some cost control mechanisms. in that we have, as I indicated, merged academy and regional training together. We've improved our purchasing and contract oversight abilities. Our technology has significantly increased. We went from an agency in 97 that had basically, it's either three or five personal computers that were not networked or linked in any fashion. Two of those served as the servers for the printers, so if someone needed to print something, whoever was working on their PC that was a server had to get off it and let them print it. Not terribly efficient. We had an AS400 that would handle only police files alone. We are now at a position where we have a networked PC system. It is very interactive. It allows us to go across disciplines basically across disciplines and communicate. We're getting to the point where we're reducing our data entry to a single entry point. We're not quite there, but we're getting there. In addition, we're now on email, and we have listserv features for our constituents so that we're in constant contact. All of those have been a significant cost savings to us. We have improved technology to the point where when we have to duplicate curriculum for people, that comes in 20 or 30 typically binders. It now can be on one CD-ROM to go out, which has significantly reduced some cost.
Are there going to be real problems of transitioning from all of this diffuse area into a single location? You'll do that probably during the biennium coming, right?
Senator Trow,
that affect your budget as you think about how that's to be done?
Senator Trow, that will impact the following budget even more than this one. This one will predominantly cover our building costs, but we will also be planning for that transition. It will definitely be a challenge.
You're not transitioning this biennium?
No. The building would not be completed until 2004, so it will be in the following biennium.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chairman Trow. As a follow-up to your question, has any dialogue occurred with the Oregon Youth Authority to bring their training into this facility as well? I know they're employing 6 to 8 people just for the specific purpose of training their employees, and I wonder if an efficiency or savings could be had.
Senator Trow, Representative Smith, there have been some discussions, and there are some areas where they would feel that they would like to train or share curriculum with us. However, their concern was, and this was dealt in the legislative two sessions ago, I believe, when we were given some of the certification authority over their instruction, but the feeling was that the type of training that they do was enough different that they felt inclined to do it within their own facilities, more as in-house training and orientation. So at this point in time, we have not done any training with them, and there hasn't been any discussion to actually bring them into the facility for training, other than the fact we work with them on their curriculum, and they do from time to time participate in some of our leadership programs.
Well, I know they have 6 to 8 employees that were hired when they were initially building their facilities. And I'm just surmising, I haven't talked with them at all about this, but I'm surmising the surge in recruitment has subsided, and there might be a savings to be had there. And then I guess I don't know their program well enough, but I would just assume that there would be an opportunity to merge them in with this and to accommodate that, because I've got to believe each and every one of your programs is very specialized, and theirs is as well. But I think it's worth looking into to see if there is an efficiency to be had.
Thank you.
I was talking about information technology predominantly. one of the goals that we have with our information system is to get to the point where we can have greater interactive with our constituents. We have gotten to the point where they can now retrieve forms from our system, so we're no longer mailing out paper forms, but we haven't gotten to the point yet where we can actually take back that information electronically, but that's coming. We have been able to install a firewall, which was I thought would be very challenging, but under the guidance of Elaine Sears, our business service director, it went very, very smoothly. We are also, another big challenge for us in our information technology area is to handle distance learning. And we did do a pilot program with Southern Oregon University, and it was one of those pilots you're glad you did because it pointed out where all the challenges are. It was successful to that extent. It was not as successful as we would have liked in some of the other areas, but it certainly did point out what some of the challenges are to having instructors online, to having materials actually coordinate and be available at any hour or any time of the day and have that be a smooth transition, other than just putting it on a computer where you sort of have a PowerPoint lecture, but that's not where we were going. We wanted a lot more interactive than that. So those will be our challenges. In the course of our reorganization, one of the things I would like to point out in terms of administrative costs, we'll talk about this more too, is that one of the areas where the agency was criticized in 97, when the governor initiated review of the agency, was that the span of control was too great for the agency, and it was recommended that we have more supervision administration to relieve that unrealistic span of control. At that point in time, it was approximately 1 in 18. Currently, we are at 1 in 13, approximately, as a ratio, and that seems to be working quite well for us. And part of that came, again, I believe, from reorganizing and getting some continuity, but it did allow us more line supervisors to be able to work with the influx of people that come in and out on in any given day through our instructor pools. So I believe we're getting to a fairly comfortable level in that particular area. Budget-related policy legislation this session, Senate Bill 365 is a bill that would allow the agency to own property, which will be potentially necessary as we complete this siting process and locate the facility. It also allows for an exception to the infrastructure, the ability to fund infrastructure through certificates of participation, and that would be necessary to do that in almost any small community. That would be probably an essential item. There's also, as I mentioned, or I guess it's mentioned earlier, House Bill 2877 and 5010, which deal with the criminal fines and assessment. In addition to that, any other bill that may come down that relates or wishes to participate from criminal fines and assessments would have an impact on the agency. House Bill 2098 and 2928 have to do with removing the sunset clause from the 911 excise, the necessary for communications. And eventually, we will need to talk about the fire insurance premium tax because we will not be able to support fire service beyond this biennium until we deal with that. So that's probably something we'll want to talk about to be preparing for next session. And I'll reserve most of the conversations about the facilities for the detailed presentation unless there's something.
Thank you, Director Middle. We appreciate that. We're going to go till about 10:15. Dan, does that give you plenty of time? Okay, far away.
Well, we'll stop if not. So.
Start with you again. Okay. The House is going to start at 10:30, so it'd be a good idea to wind it up.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from DAS for the record. The governor's proposed budget for DPSST is $26.6 million total fund. That's about a 24.7% increase from the legislatively adopted budget and about a 36% increase from current service level. The budget is primarily other funds, about 99.2%, with a little bit of federal funds. The primary source of revenue for the department is the criminal fines and assessment account, as we talked about earlier, supporting both most programs within the criminal justice program unit and the public safety memorial fund. Diane indicated the fire insurance premium tax supports the fire program. The 911 telecommunications tax that's scheduled to sunset supports telecommunicator training and certification.
Is there a legislation to renew the?
There to extend that sunset, and that's I believe still before the Advancing the Government Subcommittee.
That's correct. It's in Ways and Means.
Private security fees supports that portion of the program. There's a small grant from the Department of Transportation. Additional funds from FEMA for some weapons of from some terrorism training as well. So those are the funding sources for the program. Page four, the primary issues here are the governor's budget adds resources in the criminal justice program for regional training, distance learning, and instruction. The fire, private security, and public safety memorial fund programs are continued at current level. We continue planning for a core training facility. There's funding in the budget specifically for a project manager for the construction project. And there's debt service on certificates of participation to finance the construction, pending future legislative approval of the project and the budget itself. So we will ask you at a future time to approve a construction budget.
Do you anticipate that will be during the session or will it be during interim?
Currently, the department is going through the siting process. My expectation is when that was done, we'll have some ability to come back and talk to you about the acquisition of the property and the design of the property. There's significant work that needs to be done in design. I'm not sure if we'll get to the point of asking for the construction amount during the session, but I think acquisition and design money is something we'll certainly be back for. At this point, it's premature. The budget assumes the adoption of the legislation we talked about earlier this morning on the criminal fines and assessment account revenues. Otherwise, under the cap, we wouldn't have enough money to fund this budget. Assumes the adoption of the legislation to extend the 911 telecommunication tax beyond its sunset. And it also allocates central administration and support costs among all revenue sources, which had not been done before. The governor's March 2001 revised budget reduces the debt service by $800,000 to rebalance the criminal fines and assessment account. It's to deal with the CAMI issue that we talked about earlier this morning, and this is where we made that rebalance. The department is composed of five program units. The largest is the criminal justice program unit that deals with law enforcement, parole and probation, corrections, 911. Fire training and standards, private security, the public safety memorial fund, and capital construction as well, and for the total of $26.6 million general fund. The budget is broken down. Personal services is about 45% of the budget. Service and supplies about 33%. Capital outlay about less than a percent. About 20% debt service and less than 2% special payments. Taking you through the development of the governor's budget, page 8, the only emergency board issue is a salary adjustment. Current service level budget adjustments, position and standard inflationary changes, standard government state service charge adjustments. There's a reduction in the payment to Western Oregon University for food and housing costs based on updated student week projections and more accurate, so we made that adjustment. There's phase out of federal community policing grants the department no longer receives. There's elimination of a one-time transfer of funds, Department of Administrative Services for facilities planning. We'll be asking for more money for facilities planning, obviously, as we move forward. Additional current service level adjustments are reduction in funding for telecommunications instead of the 911 telecommunications tax. We'll ask for the funding back in a policy package. Transfer an accounting position for private security for criminal justice standards and training. And establishment of intra-agency transfers to allocate central administration and support costs to fire insurance premium tax revenues, private security fees, and the 911 telecommunication tax. Previously, all the administrative costs had been being borne by the criminal fines and assessment account, and that's not an appropriate way to cover those costs. Page 10, take you through the policy packages, and I'll go through these as quickly as I can. Package 110 is just an administrative staffing adjustment. There was a part-time personnel officer that needs to be increased to full-time. That's a 0.63 FTE increase. There'll be shift from service and supplies to personal services to cover the cost, so there's no dollars there. Package 111 is a regional criminal justice training package, 650,000 other funds and four positions. It's three regional training coordinators in Eastern, Central, and Southern Oregon. Purchases skid car and trailer for regional emergency vehicle operation training, and establishes a traffic safety coordinator with grant funds from the Department of Transportation. There's a small roll-up amount in the 0305 biennium.
Has there been any discussion on the grant funds from the Department of Transportation, whether with the new Attorney General opinion, does that put those in jeopardy at all?
Senator, Representative Hansen, the only discussions we've had with the Oregon Department of Transportation have given us the indication that these funds were not in jeopardy and they anticipated they were going to continue.
Moving ahead, package 112, also in the criminal justice program, 16-week basic police course development. There's 75 $1,000 here in one position. It phases in a full-time instructor in anticipation of the increased police course in the 0305 biennium, and there's a roll-up here. So it's just preparing for the expanded course. 114, standard and certification, a little over $500,000, four positions, four FTE. Establishes four positions to increase distance learning capabilities and adds funds for production of distance learning materials.
Let me ask a little bit about the 16-week requirement. Is that just for the police, or is that for every group that trains with you?
Senator Trill, that's just police. Corrections is doing a review of their work right now, and we were able to find enough efficiencies to keep them at 5 weeks, but there has been discussion that they, in future biennia, will need to go to seven. And parole and probation is suggesting that they may need in the future to go from 4 to 5 weeks.
So, but the 16-week is just for
just
the
law enforcement.
Okay.
Moving on to page 12, to package 115, that restores the 911 telecommunications tax, assuming that the sunset is extended. It also increases the transfer to contribute to the central management costs, as we discussed. Package 117, the Colonel Fines and Assessment Account. This eliminates the transfer to the state police that had gone through DPSST. That's now explicit in the state police budget. And it funds DPSST criminal justice programs at recommended levels and assumes passage of House Bill 5010, modifying how we do the CFAA distribution. Package 550 is debt service on the new construction. It was $5.4 million in the governor's budget. We're reducing that by $800,000 in the governor's revised. This anticipates a sale of certificates of participation for facilities construction. It will be unscheduled until the project receives legislative approval with the appropriate expenditure limitation for the construction. It also assumes passage of House Bill 5010, modifying CFAA distribution. The roll-up cost in the next biennium will depend on how large the project is, and it's hard to tell at this point. The reason we're asking you for debt service at this time without the expenditure limitation for the construction is because the emergency board can increase and establish construction expenditure limitation. The legislature would have to allocate the CFAA money for the debt service. If that's not taken care of during session, it can't be taken care of during the interim. So that's why it's important to do that, even though we can't tell you what the expenditure limitation for construction is. Try and move more quickly in the fire standards and training program.
And the budget, so.
But there's only one package in the fire standards and training budget, $50,000 federal grant just to continue a training grant that was approved by the emergency board. Too late in the biennium for that to appear in current service level. Private security, package 130, there's a workload increase. Actually, it was able to reduce the budget here by about 28,000 other funds. It does establish two positions for the increase in workload, reclasses another support position. Because the program is transitioning from initial registration, which there were lots of folks coming in to be registered, to one of doing renewals, the amount of funds we need for background checks is reduced, and that's why we're able to have a reduction in the budget here. Public Safety Memorial Fund, 141, that also adjusts the revenues from the criminal fines and assessment account to correspond with the budget model we're proposing. Capital Construction, package 985, we do have the limited duration position and expenditure limitation for the project manager, which is needed regardless of when we ask for the construction funds there. Fee and revenue changes, the only issue here is the criminal fines and assessment account, House Bill 5010, and continuation of the 911 telecommunications tax revenues based on House Bill 2098. And then finishing on page 16, the governor's revised budget and technical adjustments. The revised budget issue is the reduction in debt service based on amendments to be proposed to House Bill 5010, and that reduces the debt service by $813,375. Technical adjustments, we've got a corrections in personal service costs. They were overestimated in the budget, so we're asking for a reduction of $10,780 other funds. And we're asking you to reclassify an accounting technician 3 to an accountant 1 based on the actual review of the duties, and that's another $6,367 other funds. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Other questions? I think we're going to adjourn now. Thank you very much. You certainly got right done right at the right time. Okay, meeting's adjourned.